That's composer, Latin jazz band leader, singer, master conguero, and one of my favorites, Poncho Sanchez, with Horace Silver's Señor Blues. It's from Sanchez's 1986 album, Papa Gato. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. By the way, just to amuse Donald Trump, this is Pancho Sanchez is a Mexican-American, and look what incredible gifts he brought to this country. So I just wanted to mention that. So here we are. It's Free Your Mind Friday on Lead Stories, and you get to say it as you see it at 888-874-4888. We have had quite a week, and it seems to be the pattern now that we get all these crazy things happening throughout the week. Perhaps this is the plan to keep us occupied so that Donald Trump could get to the weekend where he conducts even more mischief for us to talk about. But we had quite a bit of a week, and I'd like to know what your thinking is, but I don't want to tell you what it is you ought to be talking about. That's for you to determine. The program is designed to give space to the listeners who have particular things that they want to share and comment about, and to help us all kind of get a different perspective on the issues of the day and about other issues that we might not have addressed but are worthy of further discussion and debate. So the floor is yours at 888-874-4888. Let's hear what you're thinking. Lots of things to talk about, and I'm not going to be telling anybody or suggesting to anybody what it is you ought to be talking about. This is your job. This is your space. Harvey from Berkeley starts us off today.
Hello, wonderful Eutrice. How are you?
Hey, Harvey. How are you?
Great. You know, first of all, I want to thank you. Remember when you always tell us that if people bother you, don't associate with them because they're just going to bring you down? And I feel you're absolutely right. And I had a case. There was a case in mind that really worked for me and based on your information. And there's this fellow I used to see at the coffee house. I always felt obliged to speak to him because I saw him all the time. And he would always go into a rage every time I spoke to him. And I noticed that, you know, the rage was always different based on, you know, politics or some other thing like that. But the rage was constant. And after talking to him for a little while, I'd always feel exhausted and drained. And I realized what was happening. It turns out that people who go into a rage, it actually, there's a physiological process that it releases endorphins. You know, when people jog for a long time or engage in different activities, especially physical activities, the body releases something called endorphins, which is the body's opiate system. It sort of makes you feel good and covers pain. And also, it turns out that when people go into a rage, a seething rage, it releases endorphins. And essentially what this guy was doing was he was getting high using me. He started like raging.
Exactly. And he was transferring his rage to you, and yes, you were in turn internalizing it.
I was not only internalizing it, but he was using me. It's like he was a drug addict, and he found he was using me to release his own endorphins by going into a rage. And afterwards, like you say, I would feel drained, and he would be all huffed up and feeling good. So I stopped talking to him. And if you're going to rage, let him rage on somebody else. I won't let him do it to me anymore. And I don't feel drained, you know, I just completely avoid the guy. So thank you for sort of setting me straight on that. One other thing is that in the middle of the Trump administration's murder and mayhem, and because fear is the mind killer, I like to create a little island of lightheartedness to lift our collective souls and give us strength to get through these harrowing times. And if you and your fantastic audience will go to YouTube and type in the name Dynamo Magic, D-Y-N-A-M-O, Magic, Dynamo Magic, in the search box there. You're sure to be delighted by his prestidigitation. He's so good that BBC gave him his own show, and he travels around the world. And one of my favorites is Dynamo Magic in India. So if you put in D-Y-N-A-M-O, Magic in India, you'll see the incredible magic this guy does. So I say, let's stay strong and triumph over the Trump fear.
Absolutely. Thanks for getting us started today.
Thank you, Utrecht.
Thank you. From Mount Vernon, Lincoln, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Utrecht?
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Life, we never know. I just want to point out a few things, and I think my reason for wanting to point these things out is for us to actually assess what is going on in the world in a better way. First, I want to point out something concerning Trump. Remember, Trump was one of those who was extolling the greatness of WikiLeaks, Julius Assange, right? Now that Trump had become president, and we now hear that the people in Trump's administration are now seeking to arrest Julius Assange. And even the head of the CIA, who once spoke well of Julius Assange, is now crying for Julius Assange's arrest. So we have to pay attention. Why is that change occurring? I also want to point out, I was looking at some videos years ago, I think it was 2000. Trump was on the Oprah Winfrey show, and he was speaking, she was actually telling him he should run for president. And one of the things Trump spoke about on Oprah's show was the need for health care. And she asked him, she said, what kind of health care would you embrace if you were president? And this was Trump's very word. He said, I would embrace universal health care. He said, universal health care. That's what he said. This was long before Obama. So we have to think about why did Trump change from universal health care. Now, the next thing I want to point out is...
But before you go on to the next thing, you need to finish these two things. What is the answer to your first question, which is, why the switch?
There's a reason why I need to point out all these things, and then it would be more appropriate for me, because they all come together.
Okay.
Before Trump, when Trump was running, Trump said what? We need better relationship with Russia. And he was very strong about this. And now, it wasn't immediately as he became president, but after a certain amount of time, especially when certain pressures started to accumulate against him, you see Trump doing things to violate a good relationship with Russia. And Trump himself was one who praised Julius Assange. I want to also point out about when Trump first started to, in the inception stage of his running for president, he didn't start out saying crazy things. The first thing he spoke about, and many people forget this, it was about vaccination and how it causes autism. He was so much against that. Okay. The mother of all bombs that Trump so-called dropped on Afghanistan, I am sure Trump did not know that that bomb existed. I myself have never heard about it before. And let's stop and think, who decided that the so-called mother of all bombs was supposed to be dropped? And who told Trump about its existence?
You're going down a long list, but I need you to kind of bring this to a tighter focus. Where are you going? You're asking the questions. I think you have some answers, so let's hear them.
Huh?
What I said, you're giving us a lot of questions, but I believe some answers.
I want everyone to stop and think about this. Doesn't this suggest that now that he's president and reality hits him about who really controls the world and who and the jeopardy of his life if he doesn't toe the line, imagine all these drastic changes. And many of them, and I'm not saying this in support of him, but it goes to show you that him, like others, in the midst, even if they had so-called some good intentions, the primary thing in them is survival of themselves and their personal gains above that of the people. Now think about all the things I've itemized, and if we really think about it, then we would view all of the, we would stop talking about Trump's mischief, and we would also talk about what is really going on behind the scenes. That's where, that's what we should address, because it is so obvious that Trump is not making these calls and these choices. And I'm not saying this in defense of him, but I'm saying for us to dig deeper and stop thinking on the one-dimensional level. If you really think about all the things of itemized, you will come up with a different perspective on this. And then we will stop the silly thing about Trump. It is bigger than all of that.
Well, we are thinking Trump, because there is an apparatus to compel us to do that. What we needed to do from the very beginning, and what we need to do now more than ever, is to think about our survival. Not so much about Trump. Trump will survive whether his administration succeeds or fails. They will all survive. All of the people in Congress making these decisions and the White House making these, they will survive. They will do quite fine. The masses of people will not do well. And it is because they are completely open and vulnerable. There is
you know
no protection. There's no protection.
You trees. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
I say this, and I've been saying this for a long time. There's very little difference between the 99% and the 1%. Much of the 1% was once the 99%. If you look at the mentality of America, much of the 99%, if they became the 1%, they would be as ruthless as the 1%. Look at something like multiple marketing, where poor people will see some item that is that could make them rich, and they'll know that it's a bogus item, and yet they will come and try to sell it to their best friends to increase their wealth, even knowing that they know that they're telling their best friends or family to make a bogus investment. If you think of that, then you realize the state of this world. We need to re-educate the 99% in terms of sensitivity. The 99% supported Hillary Clinton, even though she caused the death of Bertha Casillas of Honduras.
Yeah, but we have not, you know, Lincoln, we have not yet come to terms with one very important fact. And that is, the world is ruled by systems. And one of the reasons we have this yawning gap between those who are wealthy and powerful and those who are not is that we have no systems. We, the people who are suffering, the people at the bottom, we are without systems and we are without an understanding of systems. Multi-level marketing is a system. It's designed to do exactly what you are pointing out that it does. So it's working just fine. The inability or unwillingness of people to understand systems, how systems work, and the need, the absolute need to design and devise your own system for survival. We don't have that. We continue to point outward and say, well, they are the reason that we are suffering. No, they're not. Their systems are working fine. You have no systems. And as long as people need to get that, you have no systems that are linked to your daily survival, that allow you to thrive, that allow you to get somewhere in life. We have no real systems. We don't appreciate how important it is to understand how systems work in a bureaucracy, how systems work as a government. We don't get it. We think that, you know, they just wake up in the morning and they do X, Y, Z. They have a system that was designed to work to their advantage. We don't have a counter system, and we don't have an appreciation of how important it is. It is literally linked to our survival, but we continue to ignore the need to devise systems that give us something of a hedge against what's coming. Every single day, we see things that are happening that could, I'm not saying 100% of the time, but that could be avoided, or that in some way could be attenuated so that we can survive. But we don't have any system. We have no protections. And that is the secret of, I believe, of our survival individually and collectively. We must put in place systems. There's no guarantee that the systems will work beautifully. No system in the end works beautifully and without flaws. But the fact is that we are totally open to attack because we have no systems of defense. Thanks for calling in and sharing your thoughts with us today. Newark is next, and that's Dwight.
Good afternoon, Utrice.
Good afternoon, Dwight. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you, and I hope that you're doing well also, Utrice. And I would I would hope that the entire PRN audience is doing well also.
Thank you.
Utrice, what I would like to discuss today is a couple of things. And I would like to begin with the speech that Mike Perez made in Maine. Now, I would first like to ask, why would he choose Maine to begin recruitment or candidacy for the Democratic Party, and he started talking about local politics. Now, Maine is a very white state, and also it only has 3 electoral votes. Now, I think that when you think about Maine and you say, you ask what issues does Maine have, the issues that Mike Perez brought up, rather, was, you know, some of the housing costs that were going to be implemented with the Trump budget. He talked about heroin. Now, stuff like that, there are, like, in the larger cities, I mean, heroin abuse, it seems as if to me that those issues that are very prevalent in the urban areas and have been for years haven't been addressed. But what we see now is that once the white kids are getting hooked on heroin or either oxycodone or whatever type painkillers they use, it's a big issue. Now, then we get Bernie Sanders opening his speech to a throng of applause in Lexington, Kentucky.
And Louisville, Kentucky.
Louisville, Kentucky. And he gets a, it sounded to me as if that was just one of his primary speeches. Now, in either one of those speeches, did the Democratic Party point out any type of mechanism that they were going to use to build the party? And I think that they only used Bernie Sanders as a front man to bring in the 3 million votes that, or the 13 million votes that he brought in, and to get that, those type of people who were, showed up with Bernie Sanders, to incorporate them into to the Democratic Party. Now, we had discussed earlier that the Democratic Party could not be fixed. Now, if we believe in that theory, then can you look at it as just a ploy by the Democrats to bring in those 13 million votes that Bernie Sanders had brought in? And I mean, that's a lot of votes. We talked about the Rainbow Coalition.
Jesse Jackson.
Yeah, we talked about the 3 million votes that he brought in. Now, just think, 13 million votes to the Democratic Party. And I just don't believe that the Democratic Party has any fight in them. When I look back on it, it seems that once they got President Obama elected in 2008, when the midterm elections came up in 2010, we did horribly. In places where there had been a traditional Democratic stronghold, they were captured by the Republican Party. Now it seems like the Democratic Party regrouped again in 2012 to get President Obama reelected. But, you know, since then, I mean, the backlash from the Republican Party on the Democratic Party, I mean, they got trampled in this last election. And then I can't take any stock in the Democratic Party until they first of all explain to us some type of rational explanation about what happened. You know, like they want
to
just sweep it under the rug.
I'm listening to you're laying out your premises quite well, but I have to ask you a question. What do you think? You were commenting in a way that suggested it didn't make sense, this rollout that we just discussed of the new Democratic Party under the leadership of Tom Perez, that you're not getting it. Well, here's the thing. The party is in extremely very poor condition at a number of levels. This 8-state tour that they're taking on, which is Perez and Sanders together, is designed to do a number of things. The first thing is psychological. You now have a, quote, new Democratic Party that is under the leadership of a Latino, Perez, and an African-American Muslim. That's Keith Ellison. They've been handed this party, and their job, their mandate, is to fix the party. And they understand, because I do, I imagine they do as well, the transition that the party is attempting to make is also psychological, and it has to do with overcoming the racial barriers even within the so-called Liberal Democratic Party. There has never been a time when the party has been under non-white leadership, but this is the first time. So what they're doing, you know, through the back door is introducing themselves as the new leadership, and this is their way of introducing themselves to a constituency they want to ask to come on board, and they are very clear that, liberal or not, there are racist elements, and there have always been racist elements within the Democratic Party that may not automatically accept the leadership or the direction that the party is going under this so-called new leadership. So the tour is to place themselves in those constituencies, in those areas where they feel they have a good enough chance to present themselves in such a way that people could adjust. In our racist world, they could adjust to the vision, the new vision of the party, and kind of sign on to it. But first, they have to introduce themselves. So it wasn't so much about, well, we are fighting the other party. This whole thing is about addressing the historical barriers, racist barriers, to a cooperative movement within the Democratic Party. And it finally came to an undeniable point with Barack Obama's election as president and with Hillary Clinton. So we had under Obama the rise again within the Democratic Party and the push-pull based on racial issues. And then Hillary comes along and stokes the fire and took it in the direction of gender, the gender gap within the Democratic Party. She is the white woman. I'm woman, hear me raw. It didn't matter whether she was the best candidate, the most qualified candidate, but the party in selecting her and giving her all that support, which is why they have no money now, and which is why they're in such desperate straits right now, it was to affirm the party's commitment. This is on a purely theoretical level, to affirm the party's commitment to gender equality. They paid a lousy, lousy price for being so phony and so fake about these very vital things that they ought to have been seriously addressing. But instead, you know, in the world of politics, everything practically is temporary and nobody's thinking straight. And within the party, there was such a lopsided arrangement, power arrangement. Those people who had the opportunity and the clout to take the party in a particular direction, to reflect their own thoughts and their own concerns in particular areas and neglect all other areas. The Democratic Party has ceased to be the party of the people. It has gender problems. It has racial problems. It's got power problems within the party. So this rollout, I see it as a way of both Ellison and Perez introducing themselves to a party that was never accustomed to the objective situations that it's in. Most importantly, that the leadership of the party is now in the hands of people who within the party never enjoyed that level of power. But as we know, the party did this because it had reached a point of no return. Who is going to take on the task of rebuilding this party? Who is going to take on the ornery task of mending this party? They give it to the black guy and to the Latina guy. Fix it, and when you fixed it, we'll kick you out and, you know, we move on. That's how I see it.
Well, Utrice, I look at it like this. We can't be too certain that Tom Perez or Keith Ellison are really the heads of the Democratic Party. I still have a feeling in my gut that Hillary Clinton is lurking around in there. And the last time we heard from Hillary Clinton, it was what she would do to bomb Syria if she was the president. And within mere hours of having made that remark, Donald Trump then takes it upon himself to drop bombs on Syria. Or allegedly.
Yeah, but I agree with you to a certain extent. I believe that the new leaders, quote unquote, of the party, just like you said, I believe they actually are not leading this party. There are other people who are doing the heavy thinking. I mean, I say this all the time. The role of whites within the party is to do the heavy thinking and the leading, and the role of everybody else is to do the heavy lifting. So I see Perez and Ellison as assuming the role of heavy lifting. I don't think, personally, Hillary Clinton has any interest in rolling up her sleeves to do any kind of grunt work. They are the elite of the party. The party is divided on the basis of class and race and gender and all kinds of divisive things. Her thing is to come into the party or to operate within the party in a way that satisfies or helps her achieve her specifically personal objectives. Hillary Clinton is not a team player, never has been. She's not concerned if this body collapses and totally dies. She is concerned that even if it's on its way to dying, she should be able to extract as many benefits from the party just the same to suit her particular plans. But I don't see Hillary Clinton as a big booster and builder of the party. She never has been. Thanks so much. Great to talk with you today, Dwight. Thank you. From Connecticut, Gabriel, you're on the air. Hello, are you there? Okay. I'm waiting for a message. Gabriel, are you there? Apparently not. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. Look, I am not moving too far away from my premise that no matter what is happening in the world, the things that are happening within the context of people who have designed their system and who have designed their system in a way that allows them to prevail. We get distracted. And in the end, we're reacting to things that are just signals. We're not reacting to the objective conditions on the ground. We're distracted, for example, about how Donald Trump thinks and why is Donald Trump doing what he's doing, when that should be way down on our list of priorities. The first thing I said that we ought to do is to kind of figure out who he is, and when you figure that out, you therefore figure out what he's likely to do. And if you notice, he has not moved very far from our analysis of him. He has performed predictably, well within the boundaries that we spotted, that we called. Okay. But the purpose of analyzing Donald Trump, analyzing the bureaucracy that he's heading up, is so that we could devise systems of our own that allow us to proceed with the basic thing of survival and to do it intelligently. I'm not going to waste another minute worrying about Donald Trump. It's very clear what he's about, what his family is about. It's very clear. We don't need to repeat the cycle over and over. I think we have a pretty good idea of what we are likely to experience with a Trump leadership and a Trump administration. I want us to figure out what is our retort? What is it that we can do to survive individually and collectively? Stop worrying about them. They'll do what they're doing anyway. That's what they've been doing all their lives. The wealthy of this country, very wealthy people all over the world, they become wealthy and oppressive and undemocratic because their systems require them to do that. Why are we to be surprised? This is what they do. We ain't doing very much. That's my worry. Well, let's talk to Michael from New Jersey. Hey, Michael, how are you?
Hi, Therese, how are you?
I'm hanging in. My right arm looks very interesting with all kinds of things protruding from it, but I'm okay.
Oh, did you have that second surgery yet, or you still have
to? Yeah, I've had three already. Uh-huh. And hoping to avoid the fourth one, but things are looking like they're healing quite well now.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. And welcome to the PRN audience. Happy to address everyone. But, you know, I just had a thought that, you know, if the Democrats were really sincere, which they're not, but if they were, the way to be, and everybody wants to be a populist now, you know, Trump rose through populism. They could just say, well, we won't take a dime from any corporation. We'll only take money from individuals. And at that, no wealthy corporate individuals, just individuals. Then even if they get much less money and the corporations send tons of money to the Republicans, let's say, you could at least say, well, look, where did their money come from? And we didn't take a dime from the corporations. Therefore,
I'm trying to keep my composure here, but you're making it really tough for me today, Michael. You are speaking about laudatory, selfless acts and concepts that are totally alien to the group that's in power. Things like fairness, things like honesty, they don't have that. They don't want that. That's not the way they have operated for most of their lives, if not their entire lives. That's not the way they operate. They want some, they get some, they then want more. They get more, they then want all. They have all, then they want more. All. And then they have more all, and they want more all forever. That is almost a genetic component of their makeup. So it is something to say that we expect such laudatory acts and such high-minded ways of thinking from people who just don't recognize that as desirable, and therefore as doable. That's not what their system is. I can't say it anymore. Their system breeds into them, this is how you operate within this world because you own the world. You own the world. And therefore, you can do whatever you wish. It is the people who really are failing to recognize that a great deal of their success in life depends on formulating ways of living that help them get through. Because whether it is Donald Trump today and Joe Dokes next, and then Mary Mokes after Joe, their temperament, the way they see the world, is uniformly the same. And they will do things to maintain the universe they know. which in their heads is the way the world ought to be. They ought to be in charge. They ought to have everything. They ought to make life a living hell. The standards that they themselves do not adhere to, they expect us to not just adhere to, but to be even more resolute in our adherence to these ridiculous standards that they set for us. So it's just so important to spend some kind of time thinking about survival, systemically thinking about survival. And therefore, when we think that way, we construct different kinds of ways of approaching the business of survival. We will put in place those things that help us to survive and thrive. We cannot stake our lives on the idea that in some, you know, wee hours of the morning, people like Donald Trump will experience an epiphany and they will change. That's not the way that works. So I'm startled that you thinking that this could happen.
I have a question, and is it important now to develop systems? I think they're both important. First of all, there's nothing but systems. We have to realize that.
Correct.
We have like our breathing system, our circulatory system. Everything is a system. In your car, you have a cooling system, you have a heating system, you have a fuel system. So there's nothing but systems. So that we have to realize that they've got a big running start on these systems, and the corporations really are causing most of the pollution and most of the destruction militarily. They're spying on us through the wires. I have a cone of silence now that comes down. Remember that show?
Cone of silence, yes.
It drops from my ceiling. So here's the thing. Is it more important to build our systems? Can we get up to speed fast enough? Or do we need to find a way to deconstruct their systems?
We don't have that kind of time to waste on something that in the end benefits them. All of our energy should be directed toward we should be very selfish about this idea, but also be practical. We won't have the kind of time to basically drop everything and just concentrate on this business of constructing systems. You fix it as you go. We don't have that kind of time to just set aside to do one thing. You fix it as you go, but you become conscious that you need some kind of stabilizer so that no matter who is in office, you can continue your life. Look, there are so many communities already doing this and have been doing this for hundreds of years. I continue to refer to the Amish or the Mennonites and other groups. They don't care what is going on in Washington, D.C. They have their system, the survival, working pretty well.
Yeah, but the Washington, D.C. system is destroying them, too. I mean, the pollution, is the global warming, all of these things are overcoming the Amish
I would have to give you that point. However, I'd say that Washington, D.C. is doing that to everybody, but
correct.
Not everybody is able to fight back the way they are fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own transportation system. They have their own electrical system. In some cases, the electrical system that they have is absolutely no use of electricity. They have no housing shortage problem because they build their own houses. There's no unemployment problem because everybody's at work in these communities. They have devised a system that is well in tune with their philosophical approach to life, with their religious values, with their core values. They don't send their children to your schools. They're not buying your flat-screen TVs.
But us schlubs out here, Eutrice, this has happened over a long period of time. They've made us dependent on the different systems that they've had, and they've usurped power little by little by little. And the schlubs like me and the rest of us, we've been already conditioned. We've gone along this path so long, and we're very close to destruction now. So, you know, I think that you have to have some kind of way to impact what the destructive nature of what they're doing.
Well, I say there are communities that we can observe, and we can take a lot from these communities and apply it to our own systems of survival. That doesn't mean we have to convert to being Amish or to being a Mennonite. No, it means that they have a practical approach to life that is in sync with all of the other things that are important to them in terms of values. So we could do that. We don't need to, become paralyzed about it, because life goes on. You got to, keep moving. But you have to find a way to move smarter and to not automatically feed into a pre-planned system for your life. Right now, the government knows how many cells it needs to have available. It, as the largest prison complex in the world, that's the system. It has devised a very, very efficient system of destroying lots of communities while providing employment for entire towns. You go upstate New York, like Elmira and some of these other towns, just about everybody's employed. Who is white?
Oh, you mean for the prisons, yeah.
That's right.
Right.
So it is part of the day-to-day economy.
Right.
Now, what is the response to that? The response should be, let's see to it that we do not have the system that we are in keeping us just feeding the prison industrial complex. Let's bring an end to that.
Right.
So I'm saying we will have to make these choices, because those other choices that do not have our benefit in mind, they're working and have been working for a long time to great benefit to entirely different communities.
So we have to unravel those systems by not feeding into it.
Mm-hmm. And we use our own system. Many communities have their own schools. They don't care what you think about their schools. They know that their schools are a neat fit with their values.
Right.
And they just proceed. Now, people could have whatever views they want to have. The fact is, those children, by virtue of the fact that their education is occurring within a compatible environment, those children are not going to be part of the prison industrial complex. They are moved in different phases from one part of their system to another part of their system.
Right.
Whatever it is we want to think about it, they don't care.
The most vulnerable among us fall into that system.
Well, my point is, we don't even recognize it as a system. We do not recognize that as a system, this has been operating relatively intact for decades and producing predictable results, providing employment for one set of people, providing eternal incarceration for another set of people. If it doesn't occur to us at some point really, really soon that we ought to be not just designing and devising alternative systems, but that we ought to align our systems in such a way that we starve the malignant system that has been feeding off of our misery for so long. It's a thing we have to do.
I know.
Good to hear from you today. Loved your call. Thank you so much. Let's talk to Mohammed from Queens.
Good afternoon, Eutrice Lee.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing fine, thank you. I just wanted to compliment you on how you listen to people and let them communicate their ideas and thoughts. And I'm going to be very brief because I want at least another couple of people to get their thoughts and ideas in. I just wanted to say how important it is to learn about those systems. And whether we know it or not, we are made up of 9 different systems ourselves, right? And if we just go back to, in our learning and our study, just look at our differences. It's like the young man said before me, the skeletal, the immune, the circulatory, the digestive, and study those systems and do the analysis and look at what their goals and objectives are. And that way we can learn. One great man in my particular life experience was the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and he said, know thyself, you know. And that's really the key. Once you know yourself, just psychologically, emotionally, and then when you learn about the body systems, then you get a sense of who you are, and you can look at some goals and objectives. And if you just look at those systems inside your body, like the digestive, the circulatory, what they do, just analyze them and observe them and analyze them, and you can come up with ways to start, as you were saying earlier, start your own systems, you know, and bring about a new one. When I was in the schools and I did treatment with the young people, I would always teach them that, you know, and let them know that they were part of the new world that was going to make the changes. But the key is having your own education system, because this one miseducates you, you know, so you need to go back to putting that biology and them systems in place one at a time. And no one in there could ever tell me what a system was, you know. And they innately know this, but they just needed to put it into words. Do a little thinking. See, critical thinking is the key. Think critically, concentrate, and focus, because the greatest thing we can do as humans is to think, you know. And there's many different – you have operational and factual meanings for something, and we need to look at those operational definitions. I'm going to stop now because I want someone else to get theirs in and be considerate of the next person behind me. Thank you for hearing me.
Well, you can continue. Well, there isn't very much time left, so you might as well complete your thought and bring the program to a close today.
Okay. Well, what I understood not too very long ago, that part of my goals and objectives in life and why I was put here, because, you know, we who make it into this world – we're 1 out of 500 million, you know, the one that fertilizes that egg if you don't have a twin. So that right there makes you very special. And we're all here for a purpose. And once you learn your purpose, you know, you can work toward trying to achieve and you know, contribute to the human family and humanity. And I always try to work with that and help people understand what their gifts and talents are. That's something they'll discover. Once they discover what their gifts and talents are, then they'll know what their goals and objectives are, or if they discover their goals and objectives.
Do you believe, Mohammed, that at this phase of your life, you have a sufficient enough understanding that allows you to implement some kind of system? I'm not expecting it to be perfect by any means, but a conscious effort on your part to make yourself as in charge as you possibly can of your life outside of governmental regulation and supervision and whatnot.
Okay. What I'm doing is I'm still in the planning stages, and I did this when I worked at the Department of Education, train the younger ones in in character building and leadership skills, and they'll make those changes. I'm going to give you an example. Most of the people here are followers. You look at the average person, you ask them, a European, what are you? They'll tell you white. And we tell you, look, that's a delusion, because I was, you know, in psychoanalysis. So I said, once you've been shown that what you believe is false and you continue in that belief, then that's a delusion. You'd ask the so-called Afro-Americans what their race or color was, and they would tell you black. And I would say, now look at your arm. They look at their arm. I said, what color is that really? They say, it's brown. I said, well, why do you keep telling everyone you black? You know, think for your
We have to wrap up. I'm so sorry, because we're fast out of time. However, the conversation that you have raised really is important, and we will continue. We'll find a way to continue this conversation, because it's our only hope when we consider our survival. And that's the number one imperative in life. You have to survive. And you won't survive when you are swallowed up by a system that looks at us all as dispensable, because they have a permanent interest and we just have to go along with it, which is why their system works so well. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about this program. And, of course, it's the weekend. Surround yourselves with very positive people who bring positive dimension to your life. And put on some sneakers and run like hell for people who don't. A pleasure always, and a great privilege to be in your company. Thank you for being with me today. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.